Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 239 for May 18th, 2022. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk to Bill Burns about underwater archaeology and the recent discovery of the Endurance. So fill up your air tanks because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Andrew in California.
Hello, everybody.
And Heather, also in California.
Hi, everyone.
And I am currently in Forest Grove, Oregon, which is, I guess, just not too far outside of Portland, Oregon, to the southwest, actually at a sake distillery, which is one of the first type of thing we've stayed at in this Harvest Host membership. If, as a CRM archaeologist, you don't know what Harvest Host is, I seriously suggest checking it out, especially if you've got like a van or a camper on your truck. You can't stay there in tents, but it's generally free overnighting as long as you patronize the host. And if you're traveling across the country for work, it might be a good place to overnight, grab a glass of wine, you know, chill, and then move on. But again, you can't tent camp, but you can car camp or camper camp. So check it out. We're not an affiliate. This is just a really awesome service that we use. Okay. So, all right. So today, as you guys know, we've been alternating who picks the topics for the shows. And this week it's Heather. So I'll let Heather introduce our guest and topic today. Go ahead, Heather.
Thanks, Chris. Okay. Well, we have a esteemed guest, Bill Burns. He and I are colleagues. We work together at the same company. And he is not only, he's just a man of many trades. He is an archaeologist, terrestrial archaeologist, but he's also an underwater archaeologist, not to mention a super guy. So
nice.
And the impetus behind this podcast is the March 5th of this year discovery of the Endurance, which was Sir Ernest Shackleton's expedition ship. And it's been, I think, since 1915. It got crushed by ice and it slowly sank over a couple months or a month. And it's been lost to, it has just been lost to the sea for a while until just a little over a month ago. And so I thought it was super exciting. And I reached out to Bill and said, hey, what do you think about talking about this on our podcast? So first, I just want to introduce you to Bill.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and maybe how you got into underwater archaeology? And then we'll talk about the Endurance.
Sure. So I'm an archaeologist. I also in California, actually, but I grew up in Rhode Island. Both my parents are marine biologists, so I was kind of always surrounded by boats and the sea and the ocean stuff that was taking me out. So I've always been kind of surrounded by and fascinated by the sea. And then in college, I got into archaeology like many of us do and took a field school. And I always had kind of a slight interest in, you know, wrecks, shipwrecks and whatnot. But I didn't, you know, I was just a student, so I didn't know if that was a thing in archaeology. But I lucked out that one of my TAs in my field school, who's actually a colleague of Heather and I right now, Carrie Lynch, actually did underwater archaeology then. And she got me into it and introduced me to some a local group in Rhode Island, the Rhode Island Marine Archaeology Project. Great work with volunteers. And they got me involved and just kind of took it from there.
Great. So if you don't mind giving us a background, there may be some people that are not all that familiar with the Endurance and maybe first the history of the Endurance and then the efforts that have been undertaken to try to find it.
Sure. Pretty incredible story, both the Shackleton story and also finding the wreck. It just, when I think about the things to line up for it to all happen, it just boggles my mind, really. So,
yeah.
So for Shackleton, I believe this was going to be his third expedition into Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of this was kind of the end of the, you know, golden age of exploration, as it's called. You know, it was right when World War I was starting, which is also kind of an incredible part of the story. So the idea behind this expedition was Shackleton was going to do an overland march across Antarctica. So the Endurance was going to take them to the shoreline of Antarctica at the Weddell Sea. And from there, they were supposed to march across all of Antarctica to the other side where another ship, I believe it was called the Aurora, would be waiting for them to take them home. And they didn't get too far. They got to the Weddell Sea and immediately get stuck in ice and just stayed there for the whole time, all through the summer. And then by, I think, October, the ice ended up crushing the Endurance.
Jeez.
But luckily, all of the crew got off the boat, I mean. And I believe they had their rowboats. So I believe in a series of either camping there just on the ice until enough of the ice broke up that they could get the boats in the water. Or they might have actually dragged some of the boats a bit of a distance to get to open water where they could get the boats in. And from there, they took the lifeboats to an island off Antarctica, Elephant Island, I believe it's called,
mm-hmm.
and got rescued from there. And not a single person of that expedition actually died. I'm sorry, let me correct that. Not a single person of the Endurance expedition died, but actually the boat on the other side, the Aurora, that was supposed to be their support boat, three of those men actually died trying to set up base camps for Shackleton's expedition coming through, which never actually came through. So a few of them actually passed away.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing story of endurance, I guess. Little did they know how that ship's name would foretell their experience, right?
I know. So happy.
So, yeah, and it took a while. There's some amazing pictures. Anybody that's listening wants to just do a little, you know, search online. There's some pretty cool pictures. They did take pictures while they were stuck, and they took pictures of the ship in various states of destruction before it actually succumbed to the sea totally. And it's fascinating. So now, I don't know, when did people start deciding they wanted to find the ship?
Well, it's always been a bit of an interest. Problem is it's in Antarctica, which one, the sea levels there in the Weddell Sea are very, very deep. I think the Endurance itself was found about 10,000 feet deep, which is absolutely mind-boggling.
9,869 feet. There you go.
Absolutely incredible. And of course, the other trick is that being in Antarctica, the ice is present pretty much year round.
Right.
So it's always been an interest for people to find it, but always kind of an impossibility up until very recently when we can talk about this later, but technology for underwater archaeology has advanced by absolute leaps and bounds in the past few decades. And on top of that, not the greatest thing, but global warming has diminished the ice in the Weddell Sea quite a bit, making it a lot easier for icebreakers to get through to where the reported location was.
Great. But why don't we go into, if you can kind of take us through what were some other efforts that maybe weren't successful, that may have led to the discovery. I don't know a whole lot. I mean, I read about it, but it's all kind of way over my head as far because I'm not an underwater archaeologist. So I don't understand all the, you know, I understand some of it, you know, as far as the satellite, the roles of satellite records and everything that led to it. But I'm really curious, what were the other efforts towards trying to find the Endurance? And then how did that lead to the discovery in March of this year?
Yes, to be honest, I'm actually not aware of any previous really wholehearted expeditions to find the Endurance beforehand. I believe the group that found it this time, they're called Endurance 22, and they were put together by the Falkland Maritime Heritage Group, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Heritage Trust.
And I believe they actually did try a expedition a year or two before this current one. And for whatever reason, they weren't successful with that.
Right. Heather, I think just based on, like Bill was saying, based on the technology, I don't think you really have huge or super serious efforts to find the Endurance until, you know, relatively recently. I mean, I love this story, and I never thought they'd find the Endurance. I was like, no way, you know, because it's so extreme, and diving in conditions like that are just so hazardous and cold, and you need extra diving equipment to deal with cold weather, like dry suits and this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I never thought they would find it. So I think, like Bill is saying, you know, it's sort of a gift of the most modern of technology.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I think some of it, I guess maybe I'm referring more to what I had read about the archival, you know, reading the diaries, trying to figure out exactly where it was, because that had gotten lost to time, and trying to figure out the exact, I mean, I think they had the lat long, or they had, mm-hmm. they had some information, but it was still, you know, in the sea, you can have a lat long, or, you know, it doesn't mean it's necessarily you're going to find the ship itself, because who knows what the currents have moved, or when it went into the sea, how it's, you know, moved and drifted. So
did the ice like completely crush it, you know?
Right.
And that's another incredible thing about the story, is just the skill of the crew members, because the reported location of the Endurance was recorded by the captain of the Endurance, a man named Worsley, I believe, or Worsley.
Worsley,
correct. Yep. Yeah. And they found the Endurance only 4 miles from his reported location, with just with ice flows and currents, which the Weddell Sea is known for some of the craziest, just most dangerous currents in the oceans. It's really remarkable. So the Endurance 22 really lucked out with that bit of information, and just having the ship only 4 miles from where they thought it could be.
I think it goes to show that, and I think as archaeologists, it's important for us to remember, we can have all the technology in the world, but the people that have mastered navigation, they mastered, you know, to a small degree, that, you know, or a lesser degree, that the use of a compass, or really understanding geography and knowing how to navigate, it's really important. Just having a technology, having a Trimble or a GPS in your hand, and letting that do all the work without understanding everything that goes behind land navigation, you know, it's, I think it's something that an art that can be lost.
Yeah, I couldn't agree
more. And it's very, very important. And this right here just shows you, I mean, you have somebody back in the early 1900s, more than 100 years ago, who was able to, you know, record the location of where they were, and that we were able to find it. It just shows you how important having a master navigator, and being able to do that as archaeologists, is really important. Absolutely. How many site records do we try to relocate sites and can't find them? Right. Because people are lousy at recording locations.
Yeah, it really gives you a deeper understanding of just navigation and cartography.
It totally does. And actually, the navigation they did in the little boat from Antarctica to Elephantine Island, as Bill told the story, Elephantine Island, I think, is it 1,600 miles away or something? It's literally, you know, it's
a massive voyage.
Yeah. To find that with like a sextant, you know, it's the whole story is basically an ode to fantastic navigation.
It really is. It's mind-boggling.
All right. Why don't we stop right here and take a break and come out on the other side and talk a little bit about the current or the successful discovery effort by Endurance 22.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 239. And we are here with Bill Burns, underwater archaeologist extraordinaire. We are going to start off in this segment talking about the actual discovery of the Endurance. And then we're going to segue into underwater archaeology and CRM, which I think a lot of people might be surprised there really is a forum for that. If you're an underwater archaeologist or you're somebody who's interested in underwater archaeology and you are a CRM archaeologist, there is a place for you. So, Bill, if you could just kind of give us a rundown of the efforts for this successful discovery and exactly how it happened.
So the discovery was made by a group, Endurance 22. The real incredible part of the story, I believe, is just the new technology that they've been utilizing, discovered the wreck. So they took an icebreaker ship out of Cape Town to the Weddell Sea to look for the Endurance in the location of Wolseley's last coordinates. And they utilized this new type of underwater vehicle developed by Saab, actually. They call it Sabretooth. Now, I found this especially fascinating because up until recently, you basically, when you're looking for resources underwater, you have a whole kit of remote sensing technology at your disposal. You know, you have side scan sonar, which kind of shows you the relief of the seafloor, but doesn't penetrate into the seafloor at all. And a multi-beam is a type of sonar as well. They use it. And then you could use magnetometers, which, they detect magnetic fluctuations. So you could locate iron concretions or anything with a magnetic field with that. Or there's also sub-bottom profiles, which do penetrate into the seafloor, but give you kind of a cross-section. You know, you can't really view kind of wide areas with a sub-bottom profile. And then, of course, there's ROVs, which we're all familiar with from the Titanic and movies and whatnot. Or you could put divers in the water, which I do not envy anyone working in Antarctica.
Oh my goodness. I can't imagine. How do you, like, so I'm just curious, just stop you for one second. Like, when you were in the water, like something that cold, I'm sure you have to have special suits and everything just to make sure. And like, how long can you stay underwater?
Sure. I've never done ice diving before.
Right.
I know a few people that have, and it requires, there's all sorts of fancy equipment. There's of course you're going to be fully dry suited. You wouldn't get into that kind of water in a wetsuit, and you would have a lot of, woolies underneath, but they also create these kind of high tech warmers that you could wear in your dry suit. Basically, I think it circulates hot water inside, and you're going to have your face completely covered as well.
Right.
Often they have a surface umbilical feeds of air to the surface as well.
Okay.
So, the good side of it is often you hear in these waters, you can see forever. The visibility is just incredible.
Right.
But who wants to stay in that water for too long?
Right.
So for this expedition, they had these saber-tooths I mentioned before, which are kind of like an ROV in that it's controlled from the surface and has, cameras and can send it as an umbilical to the surface as well. So you get the real time data. This ROV was also equipped with, I believe, side scan sonar. So the ROV itself was a bit of a remote sensing equipment. So at the same time, as you're looking through the camera, it's scanning the area around. So you could see something way beyond the field of vision that might be an interest for you that you want to send the ROV to. The figures they're saying are absolutely incredible, that from its tether point or from wherever it's being controlled from, it can search for about 100 miles away, which is absolutely mind-boggling.
Wow, that's crazy.
It really is, and send that data in real time back to the operator. So this technology is brand new. And honestly, I don't see how the Endurance could have been found with any of the existing technology we had before before this.
So was there an underwater archaeologist with the crew, or was this mainly, you know, sometimes these discovery crews don't have underwater archaeologists. They're mainly, you know, scientists or of various different fields, but don't include an archaeologist. Did this one have one?
That's a very good question. And I knew what you mean. I believe the crew, Bob Ballard's crew for the Titanic, didn't have any archaeologists. Right. I think it was all oceanographers. You know, Bob Ballard is an oceanographer, not an archaeologist. For this expedition, I'm afraid to say I'm not actually aware, but I would assume that they did have an archaeologist on board.
Okay. So Bill, you know, obviously you were just saying that there is some technology here that it's really is so new, and this would not have happened if they didn't have, you know, this Saab Sabretooth technology and a few other things. What do you think, you know, as far as underwater archaeology or underwater discovery of shipwrecks, is this going to revolutionize? I mean, it sounds like it is going to. And are there other ships that you know of that, you know, people have been really wanting to find that maybe that will be the next voyage?
Yeah, that's a real good question. I do think it will actually revolutionize underwater archaeology. You know, like when any kind of new piece of equipment comes out, it takes some time to trickle down. You know, this is obviously cutting edge. And
sure,
if it wasn't bought by, you know, some a lot of funders for this particular project, they wouldn't have it. And a lot of, you know, CRM companies and just a lot of groups are not going to have this technology for a long time.
Right.
But, you know, as time goes on, like anything, the cost will go down and people will find ways to kind of recreate it, you know. So I think in time, it really will have a huge impact in underwater archaeology, because survey really is the greatest difficulty in underwater archaeology. You know, you get this vast area where you're searching either for something or just seeing if anything's there or not. But in the Arctic, it's very clear. But in most places, you know, you can't see more than 5 feet.
Right.
Andrew, I'm sure you're very familiar with just some of the incredible diving conditions that we have to go in, where you don't see your hand in front of your face, you know.
Yes, nobody thinks about that. They all think we go diving and we can see 100 feet, you know, in all directions. And it's
like
just
the Bahamas.
Yeah,
tropical fish and
people,
coral.
People will think that, you know, who don't know any better, of course, because they haven't done it. They'll think that of California, you know, and it's never, if you have 10 feet visibility, you're like, yes,
yes.
You know, and this technology, as we talk about it, it almost reminds me of like the LIDAR of the deep.
Yes.
Where it's really, really great technology if you can afford it.
Yeah, you know? Right. Exactly.
You know, I was thinking just the region that I work in a lot is Santa Barbara Channel region, mainly on the mainland. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we know that that, you know, at one point the seas were, or the ocean was lower in this area. And so there's likely would have been sites right along the islands and all over the Santa Barbara Channel region. And just like you said, surveying is so difficult to do and actually really cover an area that makes any sense at all. I mean, if you're an academic archaeologist, you know, you're limited in your funds. And if you're a CRM archaeologist, you're limited in what is required to get the job done. And, you know, the client isn't interested in doing, you know, these long-term expeditions of months and months. But I could see how this would definitely, especially when you were saying there's like this 100-mile reach where you could just actually, if it's, you know, the cost goes down, you could have one ship out there and you'd have this Sabretooth just combing the seafloor over time. And it wouldn't take a whole lot of support other than, I mean, it's obviously going to cost some money, but I definitely think that what it could discover would be just incredible.
Sure. And that's the thing about the initial cost would be, you know, huge.
Sure.
Once you have that, you know, it drop down cost to survey quite a bit because of the ground you cover. So it's it would be really incredible.
Well, the, you know, like the company that we work for, they do invest quite a bit in technology. We're really fortunate to work for a company that does that. you know, a lot of times CRM companies have to go out and rent equipment rather than, and so that, you know, obviously increases their cost. Our company has a full GPR setup, and that allows us to, where maybe other companies wouldn't even think about doing GPR. And we know GPR isn't successful in everything, but it certainly is an awesome tool in some respects. And so having that at our disposal to be able to use, if we think that it would be a tool for an effective tool for that specific purpose or site or location, I could just see that once the cost does go down, yeah, this would be an amazing tool to have in the archaeological toolbox.
Sure. Yeah. Just the option. Right.
So why don't we talk a little bit about underwater archaeology in CRM? Like I said, a lot of people are thinking that it's something that's just, you know, a few people in the country do it, which really isn't true. And it's starting to increase. There's more universities that are offering underwater archaeology classes. And it is definitely becoming more popular. And especially with, as we start working, you know, as a sector, and especially in the environmental sector, working on offshore projects, underwater archaeology is becoming more and more prevalent. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. And I want to add the caveat that I myself am still learning too. I've been in archaeology for almost 20 years now, and just trying to figure out the ins and outs, how to do it right, and how to get in on it is in itself a very tricky sea to navigate, if you'll give me that
pun. No pun intended.
Exactly. But one of the tricks I always found in underwater archaeology as opposed to terrestrial archaeology, and Andrew, you can help me out if
I shall.
I feel that it's very difficult to find an entry position in underwater archaeology. With terrestrial archaeology, say you're just fresh out of school, you know, you just got your bachelor's and you want to work in CRM, then you go work in the field. That's kind of the traditional route for most people. You don't start, you know, managing projects or writing reports. You go work in the field. For underwater archaeology, field work doesn't require large crews of people. For any field work, it's usually just kind of a few experts, you know, either running remote sensing technology or just a few divers in the water, right? But you don't really have large crews of divers around doing survey. It's usually a field that requires small groups of highly specialized people more than large groups of inexperienced people, which makes it very difficult for someone just starting out. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I would just totally agree in my experience. And one thing that Bill said just a moment ago where I'm like, ah, yes, Bill Burns is indeed the real deal, is he said, you know, in terms of how to do underwater archaeology, he said, I'm still learning. And that doesn't mean Bill still needs to learn how to dive. It means that it's almost impossible to find some sort of manual on like how to run an underwater archaeology project, right? How to do the research design. It's an extremely small community in some ways, and it's super varied, you know, so there is no straightforward path in that world. And also in terms of the crew, I totally agree with Bill in terms of, like, I tell my students who are into underwater archaeology, man, be a dirt archaeologist first, because most of the projects, they'll have like the big dirt archaeology, and then they'll have, like Bill said, a little specialty group that maybe comes in for 2 weeks and does the underwater portion.
Mm. Yeah, that's really good advice. And I like what you said too, is just the field itself is so varied as well, especially now in CRM. You know, right now in the country, we have this big offshore energy boom going on where people are trying to,
right,
you know, put in wind turbines offshore quite a lot. So that's one aspect is the offshore stuff. But then you have all these inshore projects as well, you know, wharf maintenance, coastline stuff, seawalls. With climate change, you know, seawall stuff is becoming a lot more prevalent. And then you have inshore stuff too. You know, you have lakes, you have reservoirs, you have rivers here in California.
You know, we have a few projects where they're doing shark sonar in bays along the coast of, so it's like to detect sharks in the water. Yeah. So that's been some of our work projects down in the Southern California area. So,
bay is even something else, you know. You know, you wouldn't approach how you survey a bay the same way you would do something offshore. Right. And then, you know, me and Heather, we live in California, so there's all these reservoirs in the Sierra Nevada. Yeah. And they're always, you know, how do you make a reservoir? You dam up a river. And those are always going to be the most sensitive areas for Native American sites.
Right.
So let's say almost any reservoir in California probably has underwater sites in it.
So Andrew brought up a good point. He was saying there's like no manual, like, you know, for terrestrial archaeology, we're, you know, we have the OHP, we have certain like standards that we work with. How to write a research design, maybe not how to, but what aspects need to be included in research design? How do you go about that? I'm sure, you know, there's some principal ideas that are similar, right? Because, you know, we're archaeologists and we're looking at trying to find human activity or evidence of human activity. And what does that say about us as humans? And, you know, there's those general thoughts, but is there anything like the OHP has for research design? And I think, you know what, Bill, I'm going to let you think about that a little bit and we'll go into break and take this on the other side.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 239. We're in our third segment. Bill, we were just about to touch on if there is any, you know, standards that are written for underwater archaeology, something that would be very specific when it comes to, you know, research design, work plans. Is there anything out there, or are you starting from scratch as an underwater archaeologist when you embark on a project?
Well, I feel that is something that's actually developing as we speak right now. You know, if you asked me maybe 10 or 20 years ago, I would say, no, not really. But as things get active, you know, federal and state agencies are starting to draft management plans and just practices, you know, best management practices for underwater resources. You know, it used to be more, basically it would come down to in CRM, you know, if you had an underwater project, the lead agency would kind of determine how much needed to be done.
Sure.
Or to get through cultural resources. And that was always dependent on whoever that individual reviewer would be.
Right.
You know, sometimes they would have really no kind of background or interest or idea about if underwater archaeological resources exist at all. So, you know, a lot of projects could just kind of go through federal or state review with really no consideration for cultural resources whatsoever. But as
Bill, can you start that? Say,
sure. Was that the motorcycle going by?
Yeah, you can hear. You can hardly hear what you were saying.
Yeah.
Maybe start the last sentence again.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So sorry. Let me remember what I was saying.
Sorry.
No, it's no problem. It's me. It's my mind. So sometimes you would have, you know, federal or state agencies, and it would come down to the individual reviewer. And if he had no idea, you know, underwater archaeological resources may exist or had not really been through it before, you know, they might pass through projects without a second thought for underwater cultural resources. But as time goes on, I think underwater archaeological resources are coming a bit more into public view. And underwater archaeology as a field is kind of becoming more into public view. Mm-hmm. So as that happens, you know, state and federal reviewers realize that that underworld projects do require cold review, right, just like any terrestrial project. You know?
Right.
So it really is developing as we speak right now, just kind of more standardized best management practices kind of across the board, especially with this boom for offshore wind these days. That's right. Really kind of brought it to the forefront.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as archaeologists, when we are, especially in CRM, well, actually only in CRM, in academia, you know, a lot of it's obviously what kind of grants or money that you have at your disposal. For the CRM, mm-hmm. it's the same thing. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, we get pushback. Do we really have to do this? And sure. Having those standards that are the agencies are putting together that say, this you do have to do, really kind of takes the onus off of us, kind of takes the pressure off of us and say, yes, you know, these are standards that are expected, that are required in order to fully, do our job. And so I think that that's great that that's happening, because otherwise I could see a lot of people, especially clients, that are this is being imposed on them. This survey work, underwater survey work, is being imposed on them, that they could get pushback and say, yeah, that's, you know, I don't think that's really necessary. So having those standards, I mean, that's why I asked, because that's kind of the teeth behind when we're writing proposals is the fact that, yes, this does need to be done. And to this level. I mean, it's different than when some say, okay, you have to do under, you know, a lot of times it's driven by the tribes. Mm-hmm. And tribes say, we want some underwater archaeology out there, but they don't have, okay, you know, or maybe they don't even know, you know, who would, right? Mm-hmm. It needs to be done in this way. And so sure. It's just this blanket, we want underwater archaeology done out there, but exactly what does that mean?
Yeah.
And so having the standards, I think, is really important.
That's great.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, because I mean, anyone that's done like a terrestrial project and tried to go back to a client and ask for, you know, a few $1,000 for an extra survey and experience pushback, you know, knows that. And try to go to, you know, a client and say, hey, we need to rent this Saab Sabretooth ROV for, you know, $1,000.
$200,000.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's real tricky.
Right. Yeah. Like data recovery, right? That's always how do we do this? So I'm curious. Let's say I'm an archaeologist who's you know, I have some terrestrial archaeology experience under my belt, or maybe I'm a graduate student. And I'm deciding I want to go into underwater archaeology. That sounds really cool. Mm. If I had to do it over again, I think I would have done it too. I can imagine having your graduate research with underwater archaeology, focused on underwater archaeology, would certainly help get into, get into the field. But as far as tools go, what would entail, you know, what would somebody have to have? What are the musts?
Yeah, it's, it is like we were saying before, a very tricky field to get into. And of all the underwater archaeologists I know, it seems all of us had different routes to get in. After my bachelor's degree, I volunteered for some underwater archaeology groups, and eventually I went to get my master's degree in underwater archaeology with a famous underwater archaeologist, Jeff Bailey, who's a really, really great guy out of the University of York. But that also sent me out of the country to do it. And underwater archaeology can often be a very localized field. For an archaeologist in the field now, say you only have a bachelor's degree and you really want to get into archaeology, you want to consider going to a graduate school for underwater archaeology in the States. Florida University has a great program right now. East Carolina had a great program. I'm not sure if they still do, but they might. And then back kind of when in underwater archaeology in the 70s with George Bass was getting started, Texas A&M was the place to go. But that was back in the 70s and the 80s. besides going to grad school, I would recommend, you know, if you don't want to take the dive to go into grad school, you know, fully, just look for groups, really. You can find underwater archaeology groups here and there that often are run by professional archaeologists. That's where I got my start. I'm sure there's some in California as well. Talking to professors will often help because they can, you know, get you involved in little projects that they have or whatnot. There's field schools are a great way if you don't want to, you know, fully commit to grad school yet. You could take a field school in underwater archaeology. There's plenty of them. And then you also get, you know, a fun little diving vacation somewhere. As for tools, that's actually a good point, is people often think that you have to be a diver to be an underwater archaeologist, which is not the case at all. Tons of underwater archaeology is done without diving, you know. The Endurance is a perfect example of this, you know.
That was one of my questions, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's plenty of underwater archaeologists that have never been in the water at all. And if that's a route you want to take, actually, there's actually some really incredible places that teach specifically kind of remote operated vehicle or remote sensing programs. And that is actually a very, very useful skill to have, especially these days with the technology advancing the way it is. So I would definitely recommend looking into kind of remote sensing programs. And often those are also
terrestrial as well.
Yeah. So it's a skill that is marketable in many, many ways, really.
I really think that that is one of the major future sectors of archaeology because, so, you know, for example, in Hawaii, I know that there's a movement towards less invasive archaeology. Mm. So there's a lot of remote work that goes along with archaeology in Hawaii. And that obviously just takes one area to kind of push that, to be the driving force behind the technology to make that happen. And the understanding to make that happen to then people say, this could be applied in other areas. And we see it pop up here and there, like in the rainforest and in areas where, you know, people are, you know, looking LIDAR technology and being able to find, I mean, where you, even if you're walking on the ground, you can't find these. And you can speak to that. I mean, there's, you can walk right past a temple, right? And not see it.
Oh, man. It's that LIDAR technology. Gets it. Yep. Yeah. Like I say it and nobody truly understands. It's like, no, I'm not speaking in cliches. I'm not overstating. You can literally be 3 feet away and not see it.
Right. You know. And so I think this remote sensing technology when it comes to archaeology is not just one of those things that you see on National Geographic. I think this really is the future of archaeology where you don't have to, you know, rely on one company that's creating that, you know, the LIDAR, the data set. And, you know, we have now, you know, drones. Our company has a subsidiary that is just drones. And so the companies are starting to create their own data in order to do this work. And I definitely, and it totally cuts down on cost. Just like Chris was saying, if, you know, it's in the initial, you know, cost of something is what scares people away. I think sometimes some of this technology, but once you have it, it's like a watershed moment. You can use it everywhere.
Yeah. You know, I would just add to what Bill was saying earlier and Heather, what you were just talking about, that I will say that my students who have skills in remote sensing of any kind, a lot of them with kind of geography degrees, GIS, that world, they're all getting jobs. They're just all getting jobs. And for the underwater world, I think it would be great to have that plus the underwater thing. Like I do sometimes when I have students come to me and they ask me about underwater archaeology and I go, so do you have your scuba certification? And they say, no, I'm kind of like, get your scuba certification first. While I appreciate that, you know, doing the remote sensing is a great thing. And I do think that has a big future. I also want the person who does have the tactile sense of what it's like under there.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I recommend doing it all because you can.
Sure.
Right. It's like it is a whole other world. I just started sailing and I used to look at the ocean and it was just this place that you look at, you know, it's like a landscape, right? It was just a place. And now that I'm out on the, like, I understand what I'm looking at. Like, I feel like it's another home for me now. Mm-hmm. And I understand currents better. I understand. And I, you know, you learn all this stuff in earth sciences, yes. right? But it didn't click with me until I started sailing. And now I understand. So I can definitely, I do appreciate what Bill is saying is that, you know, don't let that stop you. But I do think that, you know, just like we talk about, and everybody complains about the guy who's been, you know, been an archaeologist at their desk for their, so they don't have an right. understanding of what it's like to be on the ground and looking at things. They don't have the understanding. Like there's people that have never been an archaeologist. They're going to have right. a better understanding of what, you know, what you're looking at when you're looking at yes. the ground and what is natural and what is not. You're not going to understand that. I would think personally, you're not going to understand that unless you've experienced it.
It's so true. Cause if there's a remote sensing person on the boat and they see something and they're like, oh, just let the divers go down to 500 feet so they can grab it. You know, it's like, no, that can't right. happen. You know, no tactile knowledge.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Also with this remote sensing technology, Heather, you just said a buzzword that also made me excited about is just how innovative it is. And I really feel that was one of the success stories of this Endurance 22 expedition is that they, you know, they got down there, they saw the ship, they recorded the ship. They have absolutely incredible photography of it. You know, if anyone listening to this hasn't seen the pictures, please go online and look at the pictures of the Endurance.
Unbelievable. Like you could see the ship's wheel.
Yeah, the wheel, like, the nameplate. It looks like they just walked yesterday. Away. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, they're going around. You could see these, like, there's a small video and you can imagine they would be going around going, I think this is it. I'm not, but I don't know. We just got to, you know, I just remember, like, this is what just opened up my mind when I was a kid, when I'm dating myself, but when mm-hmm. they discovered the Titanic, I just was mm-hmm. obsessed with it. And, you know, going around and trying to figure out, like, they looked at the smokestacks. They were like, okay, this is probably it. They literally just go around and all of a sudden, oh, it mm-hmm. says Endurance. It's yeah. like right on yeah. there on the transom. You can see yeah. Endurance. It was unbelievable.
No argument what record is there.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. It's like it just happened yesterday. It's yeah. just, and you know, that all, you know, don't correct me if I'm wrong. That all happened because of the conditions, because of the very cold conditions that are not a good home for the typical bacteria and organisms that would eat away at a ship.
Is that the case? Yeah, the preservation in the Arctic is just absolutely incredible. You know, I think they said when they found the wreck, there were just some anemones growing on it, but that was about it. Right. And the anemones weren't damaging it. And the fact that they can just, you know, zip around this wreck, take photos. They don't really have to disturb the water or the sea life around it. Right. Means that the ship will be perfectly protected, which is just wonderful, really wonderful.
You know, to wrap this up, it's probably too early to tell this since it was literally just discovered recently. Do we know what any future plans are regarding this? I mean, obviously, they probably want to get down there with some, you know, now that we know where it is, get some down there with some more equipment and take more pictures and do more scans and things like that. But do we know if there's any recovery effort that's even possible with this kind of thing? Or do they even want to do that, just like leave it be and call it good?
Yeah, I don't think, I'm not sure what their plans are for the future. Yeah. I don't believe there's any kind of recovery effort involved, just because that would be, one, that would be a monumental task.
Yeah. yeah.
And two, the risk of damaging the ship would be too
huge.
Great. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And with technology as it is, like you could probably do as much studying of yep. the ship down there than bringing yeah. it up anyway, you know?
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the recording and, you know, the documentation through, you know, what they have already is
exactly
better than taking it out and then trying to piece it together and, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for like some kind of an exhibit to see. I think they can mm-hmm. do just as much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the wreck now is protected, you know, because it's in Antarctic waters. So it's part of the International Antarctica Treaty. But as far as future research expeditions, I'm not aware of any. I'm sure they'll be back for more videos and photos.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, I think we will call it good here. This has been a great topic. And Bill, thank you very much for coming on. And Heather, thanks for bringing Bill on. This has been really great.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, this was
fun.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of chances to talk about underwater archaeology on the CRM Archaeology podcast or really any of our podcasts. It's such a I don't know. It's such a almost, I don't, I almost want to say fringe kind of topic in archaeology, because they're just, I personally don't know a lot of people that are doing it and not a lot of people have the expertise or equipment to actually do it. So it's probably a really small, tight knit community. So thank you for, again, for coming on, and hopefully if you guys in your company efforts discover anything, or even if you don't, for that matter, I'm interested in how, like, you know, survey and just like planning and stuff like that for underwater archaeology projects would go, especially from a CRM aspect for this show. And, you know, maybe in the future we can get you on the archaeology show too, to talk about some more general things in the field. So again, thank you, Bill. Thanks, Heather. Thanks, Andrew. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks, Chris.
For our members, we are going to have a fourth segment where we talk to Bill about some of the equipment and other stuff needed for under archaeology. It's just a short little thing for members. So if you're not a member of the Archaeology Podcast Network, go to archpodnet.com/members. You can help support us and get access to things like these bonus segments.
I'm curious about some of the more specifics about, like, diving for a CRM project itself, the equipment that you're going to use, the number of dives per day, this kind of thing.
You know, it's we usually aim or budget for about 3 dives a day. Mm-hmm. We can push to 4 if we'd like to.
Are you just doing like a single tank dive? Are you double tank? Do you have like the scientific diver setup, or do you do sort of a more regular BC? Like, what's your?
And if you are a member, just head again over to archpodnet.com. Click on the login button and go to your member pages. And the bonus segments for shows are now contained, not in the bonus section, unless it's a one-off self-contained thing. The bonus segments are now located in the ad-free downloads area for that show. So you see the regular show ad-free, and you'll see the bonus segment for it as a separate audio file right there within the recording. So again, thanks for that. Thanks to all our members especially. And we will see you next time.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
See you guys next time.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you in the water for those that are underwater archaeologists.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one.
Fancy.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.